Well, thank you all for coming today, and thank you also to Roger Mark and the Wilson Center for convening this event and for including me. So as Roger Mark said, I've been asked to address this very complex set of issues using a human rights lens, but also from my own experience bringing in some of the humanitarian issues and human security issues, which is a phrase that I prefer to use, into how to deal with this issue. I'm going to start out by giving you a brief overview of how climate change undermines human rights, and also mention that actions to address climate change can also undermine human rights. And then I'll provide two illustrations of what that looks like on the ground. And I'm also going to close with a few recommendations. Oh, I'm supposed to change the slides. Yes, thank you. That would be me. No, that's okay. Yeah. I think I can handle it. Okay. So it's been widely recognized by the Human Rights Council, by governments, by human rights experts that climate change will directly and indirectly undermine the realization and enjoyment of a wide range of human rights. They're listed here, but I'll focus on a few ones that are significant. The right to life. Climate change will pose direct and indirect threats to human lives, including an increase in the number of deaths, disease, and injury from heat waves, floods, storms, etc. As a consequence of climate change, food production is projected to decrease in poorer regions of the world, leading to more hunger. Loss of glaciers and snowpack will impact water availability for 1/6 of the world's population, who's reliant on melting snow from mountain ranges for their fresh water. The health impacts of climate change, which I think are particularly important and probably maybe one of the areas that we may see a wider public interest in this issue, are significant. Climate change is projected to impact the health of millions of people through not just an increase in malnutrition, but an increase in disease and disease vectors. The right to adequate housing. Climate change is going to affect the right to housing in many ways. Sea level rise, storm surges, flooding will have the direct impact on millions of people who live in settlements in low-lying coastal areas and in mega deltas. And in fact, in the Arctic region and in some low-lying island countries, we're already seeing people that, because of these causes, are need to relocate and are relocating. And finally, climate change underwrites the right to self-determination. Sea level rise and extreme weather events are threatening the habitability, and in the longer term, the very existence of many low-lying island countries that are between 3 and 9 feet above sea level. This is obviously the issue of the quote-unquote climate refugees that we hear about all the time. It's probably one of the most profound human rights impacts of climate change, and one for which there is currently no solution. Unfortunately, these impacts are going to be felt disproportionately, and they will be felt disproportionately on certain people due to their geography, their gender, disability, or minority status, and it will be felt disproportionately on people that probably are not really contributing to the problem to begin with. Here are some of the groups that will be particularly impacted. I just want to focus on women and children in the time I have. Women and children are particularly impacted by climate change, and it undermines their human rights. Women and children are more likely to suffer death or injury during extreme weather events and to experience disruptions of their social networks, family lives, and education in the aftermath of disasters. In their roles as farmers and in collecting water, women are more likely to be impacted negatively by food insecurity and water availability brought on by drought and water stress. Climate change-related events and stress have also been linked to other indirect harms on women and children, including increases in domestic violence, early marriage, sex trafficking, and child labor. So, What is the challenge we're looking at? Well, don't worry, I'm not going to try to explain this Venn diagram, which is very complicated. But I think it does show what we're looking at here and how the different factors and different trends come together, and how certain interactions, both interventions and other things, can either increase resilience or decrease resilience to these complex and some people call compounding risk areas. I think the most important takeaway that I have is that understanding the degree of risk that climate change poses to human rights and to human security requires an understanding of the pre-existing socioeconomic, political, cultural, and other factors that render certain people more vulnerable to climate change to begin with. But the effects of climate change can't be addressed in isolation, and they won't be experienced in isolation. They'll be experienced in a combination with other accelerating changes, and many of the other speakers have and will allude to these: rapid urbanization, population growth, et cetera. So I want to move more interestingly to the illustrations. And I'm going to use two illustrations of what does this really look like in the ground, and what are the challenges that these issues pose to developing conflict and fragile states, conflict-ridden and fragile states. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about, just briefly, climate change and conflict. The literature examining the link between climate change and armed conflict actually shows very little evidence that climate change directly triggers armed conflict. The studies do show, however, that many factors that are linked to a higher risk of violent conflict, which includes slow rates of economic growth, low per capita income, economic shocks, are themselves sensitive to climate change. More importantly, ongoing or recent conflict renders governments, institutions, and people highly vulnerable to climate change and less resilient to its impacts. So let's describe how this played out in the Horn of Africa and in Somalia in 2011 and 2012. As most of you know, in 2011, the Horn of Africa suffered from a very serious drought. In Somalia, however, decades of armed conflict had severely weakened the capacity of people to cope with the drought. And to begin with, Somalia was a country where the vast majority of people are reliant on rain-fed agriculture to survive. They're farmers and pastoralists. The lack of a functioning government meant that, you know, unlike California, there was nobody there to help these people when they needed water and food. And in addition to that, international humanitarian actors had a very difficult time accessing people inside Somalia who needed assistance. And that was due to the ongoing violence, but also the fact that humanitarians themselves are now often a target of violence. The result is that whereas there was a drought in Ethiopia, a drought in Kenya, in Somalia the drought becomes a famine. More than 250,000 people died. 1 million were internally displaced. That was 1/10 of the country's population. And close to 1 million people were forced to flee to neighboring countries just to survive, essentially. Now, as we mentioned, the Dadaab refugee camp where many of those people went, we're now along, 5 years later, many of those people are obviously still there, and the ongoing insecurity in Somalia has made it very hard for them to go back. But another factor is that ongoing environmental degradation and climate change has made it harder for people who are going back to recover their livelihoods. So now we see climate change becoming not only a cause of displacement, but it's an obstacle to return. The second example I'd like to use, very, very different context, is the Philippines and Typhoon Haiyan. And focus a little bit more in how a different type of displacement. So climate change obviously is anticipated to expect in more weather-related hazards. We've seen that. Already every year on average, 23 million people are newly displaced by sudden onset natural hazards, and that is primarily floods and storms. And that is far more people that are displaced every year by conflict. But it's also recognized that human factors significantly contribute to the extent of damages disasters cause. Poor development, lack of land use planning, substandard housing and infrastructure, rapid urbanization, environmental degradation, the list goes on. These also contribute to disaster-related deaths, losses, and displacement. So how did this play out in the Philippines? Well, the Philippines is unlike Somalia, it's a middle-income developing country. It has actually quite a strong system of governance. It has good disastrous reduction management institutions in place. But then the strongest storm on record makes landfall there. And this is where we have to remember that these events are, again, outside the normal. So whereas the Philippines gets 15 to 20 typhoons every year, when you have 200 mile an hour sustained winds on landfall, there's nothing, believe me, I was there, nothing is standing afterwards. The typhoon displaced 4 million people, most of whom were poor and lived in informal settlements along the coast. Following the typhoon, the government decides to put in place a no-build zone in order to protect people from future displacement. So along the coastal areas, those people who had lived in those areas couldn't go back, and the government was planning to resettle them elsewhere. But the problem is that the plan was poorly implemented, and it also didn't recognize the rights of the affected people. And more than a year later, when I went back, there were tens of thousands of people that were still displaced. And where resettlement was going on, people were being moved to land that didn't have water, electricity, or access to services. So it's a good example not only of how climate change effects impact the poorest people, but also how interventions, if they don't respect human rights, can also serve to actually increase vulnerabilities and undermine resilience. So moving finally to the recommendations, I echo what both Ruth and James said, and many of the things they said, and there's some overlap here. I mean, I definitely believe we need to focus on how climate change is affecting a fragile and conflict-ridden states. At present, 43% of the world's poor live in countries that are considered fragile, and 80% of overseas development assistance goes to fragile states. But there are very few examples of how adaptation programming or funding are channeling that money to build resilience of populations to climate risk. I'll give a little spoiler alert for the G7 report that the Wilson Center has contributed to that's going to be released, I think, here in a few weeks. I think it's called A New Climate for Peace, mm-hmm. that focuses specifically on the need to better address climate risk in fragile and conflict-ridden states. The second recommendation is about pooling funding as a strategy for breaking down the silos that we currently see. As James alluded to, humanitarians often get stuck with responding to these mega disasters. There are very, very few investments. In fact, less than 1% of ODA goes into programs to reduce disaster risk. And that is a big problem. And there's no way that even if the developing countries meet their obligations in the short and the long term to build up climate change adaptation funding, there's no way that's going to be enough money to address these complexities. So we need to look for ways to pool funding and to mainstream these issues across all the sectors. I want to give one example. The good news is that the new Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction, sorry if I'm talking about something people don't know about, but the new sort of global framework for addressing disaster risk reduction was recently agreed to in Japan. And it grounds disasters firmly in a development context rather than making them about the response to humanitarian disasters. Unfortunately, the framework didn't achieve a strong commitment from countries or donors to funding DRR. However, there's an upcoming conference, Financing for Development, in Addis in July, and that is an opportunity for donors and governments to commit to increasing the amount of ODA that goes into reducing disaster risk and building climate resilience. Lastly, I mean, I think the examples I gave explain how important it is to ensure that adaptation funding is channeled in a way that takes advantage of an opportunity to build human rights. And I'm going to use example, again, back to the example I like to use, or the recommendation, is relates to my own field. And that is the fact that very few countries have in their adaptation plans how to deal with displacement from disasters. And the example of the Philippines shows that they didn't have a legal framework or an institutional framework in place to move people out of harm's way. So what happens is that post-disaster, like which is what happened, the same thing in the Indian Ocean tsunami, there's a hasty effort to get people out of tents and move them somewhere else, but it's done in a way that creates more vulnerabilities and undermines human rights. So I urge development and humanitarian and DRR funders to look for opportunities to channel this funding in a way that promotes rights. Thanks very much, and I look forward to the Q&A.